to line, allowed themselves to be coordinated, they would be safe. Though the survey also found a surprising tendency among non-Jewish Berliners to occasionally step out of line. Some 32% recalled telling anti-Nazi jokes, and 49% claimed to have listened to illegal radio broadcasts from Britain and elsewhere. However, they only dared to commit such infractions in private or among trusted friends, for they understood that the consequences could be lethal. For the Dodds, at first, it was all so novel and unlikely as to be almost funny. Martha laughed the first time her friend Mildred Fish Harnack insisted they go into a bathroom for a private conversation. Mildred believed that bathrooms, being sparsely furnished, were more difficult to fit with listening devices than a cluttered living room. Even then Mildred would whisper almost inaudibly, Martha wrote. It was Rudolf Diels who first conveyed to Martha the unfunny reality of Germany's emerging culture of surveillance. One day he invited her to his office and with evident pride showed her an array of equipment used for recording telephone conversations. He led her to believe that eavesdropping apparatus had indeed been installed in the chancery of the U.S. Embassy and in her home. Prevailing wisdom held that Nazi agents hid their microphones in telephones to pick up conversations in the surrounding rooms. Late one night, Diels seemed to confirm this. Martha and he had gone dancing. Afterward, upon arrival at her house, Diels accompanied her upstairs to the library for a drink. He was uneasy and wanted to talk. Martha grabbed a large pillow, then walked across the room toward her father's desk. Diels, perplexed, asked what she was doing. She told him she planned to put the pillow over the telephone. Diels nodded slowly, she recalled, and a sinister smile crossed his lips. She told her father about it the next day. The news surprised him. Though he accepted the fact of intercepted mail, tapped telephones and telegraph lines, and the likelihood of eavesdropping at the chancery, he never would have imagined a government so brazen as to place microphones in a diplomat's private residence. He took it seriously, however. By now he had seen enough unexpected behavior from Hitler and his underlings to show him that anything was possible. He filled a cardboard box with cotton, Martha recalled, and used it to cover his own telephone whenever a conversation in the library shifted to confidential territory. As time passed, the Dodds found themselves confronting an amorphous anxiety that infiltrated their days and gradually altered the way they lived their lives. The change came about slowly, arriving like a pale mist that slipped into every crevice. It was something everyone who lived in Berlin seemed to experience. You began to think differently about whom you met for lunch, and for that matter, what café or restaurant you chose, because rumors circulated about which establishments were favorite targets of Gestapo agents. The bar at the Adlon, for example. You lingered at street corners a beat or two longer to see if the faces you saw at the last corner had now turned up at this one. In the most casual of circumstances, you spoke carefully and paid attention to those around you in a way you never had before. Berliners came to practice what became known as the German glance, der Deutsche Blick, a quick look in all directions when encountering a friend or acquaintance on the street. The Dodds' home life became less and less spontaneous. They grew especially to distrust their butler, Fritz, who had a knack for moving soundlessly. Martha suspected that he listened in when she had friends and lovers in the house. Whenever he appeared in the midst of a family conversation, the talk would wither and become desultory, an almost unconscious reaction. After vacations and weekends away, the family's return was always darkened by the likelihood that in their absence new devices had been installed, old ones refreshed. There is no way on earth one can describe in the coldness of words on paper what this espionage can do to the human being, Martha wrote. It suppressed routine discourse. The family's conferences and freedom of speech and action were so circumscribed we lost even the faintest resemblance to a normal American family. Whenever we wanted to talk, we had to look around corners and behind doors, watch for the telephone, and speak in whispers. The strain of all this took a toll on Martha's mother. As time went on and the horror increased, Martha wrote, "Her courtesy and graciousness towards the Nazi officials she was forced to meet, entertain, and sit beside, became so intense a burden she could scarcely bear it." Martha eventually found herself deploying rudimentary codes in communications with friends, an increasingly common practice throughout Germany. Her friend Mildred used a code for letters home, in which she crafted sentences that meant the opposite of what the words themselves indicated. That such practices had become usual and necessary was difficult for outsiders to understand. An American professor who was a friend of the Dodds, Peter Olden, wrote to Dodd on January 30, 1934, to tell him he had received a message from his brother-in-law in Germany in which the man described a code he planned to use in all further correspondence. The word rain, in any context, would mean he had been placed in a concentration camp. The word snow would mean he was being tortured. "It seems absolutely unbelievable," Olden told Dodd. "If you think that this is really something in the nature of a bad joke, I wonder if you could mention so in a letter to me." Dodd's careful reply was a study in deliberate omission, though his meaning was clear. He had come to believe that even diplomatic correspondence was intercepted and read by German agents. A subject of growing concern was the number of German employees who worked for the consulate and the embassy. One clerk in particular had drawn the attention of consular officials, Heinrich Rockall, a longtime employee who helped prepare reports for the American commercial attaché, whose offices were on the first floor of the Bellevuestrasse consulate. In his spare time, Rockall had founded a pro-Nazi organization, the Association of Former German Students in America, which issued a publication called Rundbriefe. Lately, Rockall had been discovered trying to find out the contents of confidential reports of the commercial attaché, according to a memorandum that Acting Consul General Geist sent to Washington. He has also had conversations with other German members of the staff who assist in the reporting work, and intimated to these that their work should be in every respect favorable to the present regime. In one issue of the Rundbriefe, Geist found an article in which disparaging allusions were made to the ambassador, as well as to Mr. Messerschmitt. For Geist, this was the last straw. Citing the clerk's overt act of disloyalty to his chiefs, Geist fired him. Dodd realized that the best way to have a truly private conversation with anyone was to meet in the Tiergarten for a walk, as Dodd often did with his British counterpart, Sir Eric Phipps. "I shall be walking at 11:30 on the Hermann Göringstrasse alongside the Tiergarten," Dodd told Phipps in a telephone call at 10 o'clock one morning. "Would you be able to meet me there and talk for a while?" And Phipps, on another occasion, sent Dodd a handwritten note asking, "Could we meet tomorrow morning at 12 o'clock in the Ziegesalle, between the Tiergartenstrasse and the Charlottenburger Chaussee on the right side, going from here?" Whether listening devices truly laced the embassy and the Dodds' home cannot be known, but the salient fact was that the Dodds came to see Nazi surveillance as omnipresent. Despite the toll this perception increasingly took on their lives, they believed they had one significant advantage over their German peers: that no physical harm would come to them. Martha's own privileged status offered no protection to her friends, however, and here Martha had particular cause for concern because of the nature of the men and women she befriended. She had to be especially watchful in her relationship with Boris. As a representative of a government reviled by the Nazis, he was beyond doubt a target of surveillance. And with Mildred and Arvid Harnack, both of whom had grown increasingly opposed to the Nazi regime and were taking their first steps toward building a loose association of men and women committed to resisting Nazi power. "If I had been with people who had been brave or reckless enough to talk in opposition to Hitler," Martha wrote in her memoir, "I spent sleepless nights wondering if a dictaphone or a telephone had registered the conversation, or if men had followed and overheard. In that winter of 1933-34, her anxiety blossomed into a kind of terror that bordered on the hysterical, as she described it. Never had she been more afraid. She lay in her own bed, in her own room, with her parents upstairs, objectively as safe as could be, and yet as shadows cast by the dim street lamps outside played across her ceiling, she could not keep the terror from staining the night. She heard, or imagined she heard, the grating of hard-soled shoes on the gravel in the drive below, the sound tentative and intermittent, as if someone was watching her bedroom. By day, the many windows in her room brought light and color. At night, they conjured vulnerability. Moonlight cast moving shadows on the lawns and walks, and beside the tall pillars of the entrance gate. Some nights she imagined hearing whispered conversations, even distant gunshots, though by day she was able to dismiss these as the products of wind blowing across gravel and engine backfires. But anything was possible. "I often felt such terror," she wrote, "that occasionally I would wake up my mother and ask her to come and sleep in my room." Chapter 32. Storm Warning. In February 1934, rumors reached Dodd that suggested the conflict between Hitler and Captain Röhm had attained a new level of intensity. The rumors were well-founded. Toward the end of the month, Hitler appeared before a gathering of the top officers of Röhm's SA, Heinrich Himmler's SS, and the regular army, the Reichswehr. Present with him on the dais were Röhm and Minister of Defense Blumberg. The atmosphere in the room was charged. All present knew of the simmering conflict between the SA and the army, and expected Hitler to address the issue. First, Hitler spoke of broader matters. Germany, he declared, needed more room in which to expand, more living space for our surplus population. And Germany, he said, must be ready to take it. "The Western powers will never yield this vital space to us," Hitler said. "That is why a series of decisive blows may become necessary, first in the West, and then in the East." After further elaboration, he turned to Röhm. All in the room knew of Röhm's ambitions. A few weeks earlier, Röhm had made a formal proposal that the Reichswehr, SA, and SS be consolidated under a single ministry, leaving unsaid but implied that he himself should be the minister in charge. Now looking directly at Röhm, Hitler said, "The SA must limit itself to its political task." Röhm maintained an expression of indifference. Hitler continued, "The Minister of War may call upon the SA for border control and for pre-military instruction." This, too, was a humiliation. Not only was Hitler consigning the SA to the decidedly inglorious tasks of border control and training, but he was explicitly placing Röhm in an inferior position to Blumberg as the recipient of orders, not the originator. Röhm still did not react. Hitler said, "I expect from the SA loyal execution of the work entrusted to it." After concluding his speech, Hitler turned to Röhm, took his arm, and grasped his hand. Each looked into the other's eyes. It was an orchestrated moment, meant to convey reconciliation. Hitler left. Acting his part, Röhm now invited the gathered officers to lunch at his quarters. The banquet, in typical SA style, was lavish, accompanied by a torrent of champagne, but the atmosphere was anything but convivial. At an appropriate moment, Röhm and his SA men stood to signal that the luncheon had come to an end. Heels clicked. A forest of arms shot outward in the Hitler salute. Heils were barked, and the army leaders made their exit. Röhm and his men remained behind. They drank more champagne, but their mood was glum. For Röhm, Hitler's remarks constituted a betrayal of their long association. Hitler seemed to have forgotten the crucial role the stormtroopers had played in bringing him to power. Now, to no one in particular, Rome said, "That was a new Versailles treaty." A few moments later, he added, "Hitler? If only we could get rid of that limp rag." The SA men lingered a while longer, trading angry reactions to Hitler's speech. All this witnessed by a senior SA officer named Victor Lütze, who found it deeply troubling. A few days later, Lütze reported the episode to Rudolf Hess, at this point one of Hitler's closest aides, who urged Lütze to see Hitler in person and tell him everything. Upon hearing Lütze's account, Hitler replied, "We'll have to let the thing ripen." Chapter 33. Memorandum of a Conversation with Hitler. Dodd's happy anticipation of his upcoming leave was marred by two unexpected demands. The first came on Monday, March 5, 1934, when he was summoned to the office of Foreign Minister Neurath, who angrily demanded that he do something to halt a mock trial of Hitler set to take place 2 days later in New York's Madison Square Garden. The trial was organized by the American Jewish Congress, with support from the American Federation of Labor and a couple of dozen other Jewish and anti-Nazi organizations. The plan so outraged Hitler that he ordered Neurath and his diplomats in Berlin and Washington to stop it. One result was a sequence of official protests, replies, and memoranda that revealed both Germany's sensitivity to outside opinion and the lengths U.S. officials felt compelled to go to avoid direct criticism of Hitler and his party. The degree of restraint would have been comical if the stakes had not been so high, and raised a question. Why were the State Department and President Roosevelt so hesitant to express in frank terms how they really felt about Hitler, at a time when such expressions clearly could have had a powerful effect on his prestige in the world? Germany's embassy in Washington had first gotten wind of the planned trial several weeks earlier, in February, through advertisements in the New York Times. Germany's ambassador to the United States, Hans Luther, promptly complained to Secretary of State Hull, whose response was careful. "I stated that I was sorry to see these differences arise between persons in his country and in mine, that I would give the matter all due attention, such as might be possible and justifiable in all of the circumstances." On March 1, 1934, the German embassy's number two man, Rudolf Leitner, met with a State Department official named John Hickerson, and urged him to do something to prevent this trial because of its lamentable effect on German public opinion if it should take place. Hickerson replied that, owing to our constitutional guarantees of freedom of expression, the federal government could do nothing to stop it. Leitner found this difficult to fathom. He told Hickerson that if the circumstances were reversed, the German government would certainly find a way of stopping such a proceeding. On this point, Hickerson had no doubt. "I replied," Hickerson wrote, "that it is my understanding that the German government is not so limited in the action which it can take in such matters as the American government." The next day, Friday, March 2nd, Ambassador Luther had a second meeting with Secretary Hull to protest the trial. Hull himself would have preferred that the mock trial not occur. It complicated things and had the potential of further reducing Germany's willingness to pay its debts. At the same time, he disliked the Nazi regime. Although he avoided any direct statement of criticism, he took a certain pleasure in telling the German ambassador that the men slated to speak at the trial were not in the slightest under the control of the federal government, and therefore the State Department was powerless to intervene. It was then that Foreign Minister Neurath summoned Dodd to his office. Neurath kept him waiting 10 minutes, which Dodd noticed and resented. The delay reminded him of Neurath's snub the previous October after his Columbus Day speech about Gracchus and Caesar. Neurath handed him an aide-de-memoir, a written statement given by one diplomat to another, typically on a serious matter where verbal delivery might distort the intended message. This one was unexpectedly intemperate and threatening. It called the planned mock trial a malicious demonstration, and cited a pattern of similarly insulting expressions that had taken place in the United States throughout the preceding year, describing these as a combat tantamount to direct interference in the internal affairs of another country. The document also attacked an ongoing Jewish-American boycott of German goods promoted by the American Jewish Congress. Playing to America's fears of a German bond default, it claimed the boycott had reduced Germany's balance of payments with the United States to such an extent that the fulfillment of the obligations of German companies to their American creditors has only been partially possible. Neurath ended the aid memoir by declaring that because of the mock trial, maintenance of friendly relations, sincerely desired by both governments, is rendered extremely difficult thereby. After reading it, Dodd explained quietly that in America, nobody could suppress a private or public meeting, a point the Germans seemed utterly unable to grasp. Dodd also hinted that Germany had brought these public relations troubles upon itself. I reminded the minister that many things still occur here, shocking to foreign public opinion. After the meeting, Dodd cabled Secretary Hull and told him the mock trial had made an extraordinary impression on the German government. Dodd ordered his staff to translate Neurath's aid memoir and only then sent it to Hull by mail. On the morning before the mock trial, German Ambassador Luther tried again to stop it. This time he called on Undersecretary William Phillips, who also told him nothing could be done. Luther demanded that the department announce immediately that nothing which was to be said at the meeting would represent the views of the government. Here, too, Phillips demurred. Not enough time remained to prepare such a statement, he explained. He added that it would be inappropriate for the Secretary of State to attempt to anticipate what the speakers would or would not say at the trial. Luther made one last try and asked that the State Department at least issue such a disavowal on the morning after the trial. Phillips said he could not commit the department, but would take the matter under consideration. The trial took place as planned, guarded by 320 uniformed New York City policemen. Inside Madison Square Garden, 40 plainclothes detectives circulated among the 20,000 people in attendance. The 20 witnesses who testified during the trial included Rabbi Stephen Wise, Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, and a former Secretary of State, Bainbridge Colby, who delivered the opening remarks. The trial found Hitler guilty. We declare that the Hitler government is compelling the German people to turn back from civilization to an antiquated and barbarous despotism which menaces the progress of mankind toward peace and freedom and is a present threat against civilized life throughout the world. At a press conference the next day, Philip stated that he had no comment other than to reemphasize the private nature of the gathering and that no member of the administration was present. Phillips and fellow officials turned their attention to other matters. As would soon become apparent, however, Germany was not yet willing to let the matter drop. The second distasteful task that Dodd had to complete before his departure was to meet with Hitler. He had received an order from Secretary Hull directing him to convey to the Chancellor America's dismay at a burst of Nazi propaganda recently unleashed within the United States. Putzi Hanfstengel arranged the meeting, which was to be private and secret, just Hitler and Dodd. And so on Wednesday, March 7th, shortly before 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Dodd once again found himself in the Reich Chancellery, making his way to Hitler's office past the usual cadre of guards clicking and saluting. First, Dodd asked Hitler whether he had a personal message for Roosevelt that Dodd might deliver in person when he met with the president in Washington. Hitler paused. He looked at Dodd a moment. "I am very much obliged to you," he said, "but this takes me by surprise, and I wish you would give me time to think the subject over and let me talk with you again." Dodd and Hitler conversed a few moments about innocuous things, before Dodd turned to the matter at hand. The unfortunate propaganda which has been made in the United States, as Dodd recounted in a memorandum he composed after the meeting. Hitler pretended astonishment, Dodd wrote, and then asked for details. Within the last 10 days, Dodd told him, a Nazi pamphlet had begun circulating in the United States that contained what Dodd described as an appeal to Germans in other countries to think themselves always as Germans and owing moral, if not political, allegiance to the fatherland. Dodd likened it to similar propaganda distributed in the United States in 1913, well before America entered the past war. Hitler flared. "Ach," he snapped, "that is all Jewish lies. If I find out who does that, I will put him out of the country at once." With this, the conversation veered into a broader, more venomous discussion of the Jewish problem. Hitler condemned all Jews and blamed them for whatever bad feeling had arisen in America toward Germany. He became enraged and exclaimed, "Damn the Jews!" Given Hitler's fury, Dodd thought it prudent to refrain from raising the subject of the mock trial, which would take place later that day, New York time. Hitler didn't mention it either. Instead, Dodd turned to how the Jewish situation might be resolved peacefully and humanely. "You know there is a Jewish problem in other countries," Dodd told Hitler. Dodd proceeded to describe how the State Department was providing unofficial encouragement to a new organization established by the League of Nations under the direction of James G. McDonald, newly appointed High Commissioner for Refugees from Germany to relocate Jews, as Dodd put it, without too much suffering. Hitler dismissed it out of hand. The effort would fail, he said, no matter how much money the commission raised. The Jews, he said, would turn it into a weapon to attack Germany and make endless trouble. Dodd countered that Germany's current approach was doing great damage to the country's reputation in America. Oddly, Dodd now sought to find a kind of middle ground with the dictator. He told Hitler, "You know, a number of high positions in our country are at present occupied by Jews, both in New York and Illinois." He named several eminent fair-minded Hebrews, including Henry Morgenthau, Jr., Roosevelt's Secretary of the Treasury since January. Dodd explained to Hitler that where the question of overactivity of Jews in university or official life made trouble, we had managed to redistribute the offices in such a way as not to give great offense, and that wealthy Jews continued to support institutions which had limited the number of Jews who held high positions. Dodd cited one such example in Chicago and added, "The Jews in Illinois constituted no serious problem." Dodd, in his memorandum, explained, "My idea was to suggest a different procedure from that which has been followed here, of course, never giving pointed advice." Hitler shot back that 59% of all offices in Russia were held by Jews, that they had ruined that country, and that they intended to ruin Germany. More furious now than ever, Hitler proclaimed, "If they continue their activity, we shall make a complete end to all of them in this country." It was a strange moment. Here was Dodd, the humble Jeffersonian, schooled to view statesmen as rational creatures, seated before the leader of one of Europe's great nations as that leader grew nearly hysterical with fury and threatened to destroy a portion of his own population. It was extraordinary, utterly alien to his experience. Dodd calmly turned the conversation back to American perceptions and told Hitler that public opinion in the United States is firmly convinced that the German people, if not their government, are militaristic, if not actually warlike, and that most people of the United States have the feeling that Germany is aiming one day to go to war. Dodd asked, "Is there any real basis for that?" "There is absolutely no basis," Hitler said. His rage seemed to subside. "Germany wants peace and will do everything in her power to keep the peace. But Germany demands and will have equality of rights in the matter of armaments." Dodd cautioned that Roosevelt placed high importance on respect for existing national boundaries. On that score, Hitler said, Roosevelt's attitude matched his own, and for that he professed to be very grateful. Well then, Dodd asked, would Germany consider taking part in a new international disarmament conference? Hitler waved off the question and again attacked the Jews. It was they, he charged, who had promoted the perception that Germany wanted war. Dodd steered him back. Would Hitler agree to 2 points? That no nation should cross another nation's boundaries, and that all European nations should agree to a supervisory commission and respect the rulings of such a body. Yes, Hitler said, and did so, Dodd observed, heartily. Later Dodd wrote a description of Hitler in his diary. He is romantic-minded and half-informed about great historical events and men in Germany. He had a semi-criminal record. He has definitely said on a number of occasions that a people survives by fighting, and dies as a consequence of peaceful policies. His influence is, and has been, wholly belligerent. How, then, could one reconcile this with Hitler's many declarations of peaceful intent? As before, Dodd believed Hitler was perfectly sincere about wanting peace. Now, however, the ambassador had realized, as had Messerschmitt before him, that Hitler's real purpose was to buy time to allow Germany to rearm. Hitler wanted peace only to prepare for war. In the back of his mind, Dodd wrote, is the old German idea of dominating Europe through warfare. Dodd prepared for his voyage. Though he would be gone 2 months, he planned to leave his wife, Martha, and Bill behind in Berlin. He would miss them, but he could hardly wait to get on that ship bound for America and his farm. Less cheery was the prospect of the meetings he would have to attend at the State Department immediately after his arrival. He planned to take the opportunity to continue his campaign to make the Foreign Service more egalitarian by confronting directly the members of the Pretty Good Club. Undersecretary Phillips, Moffat, Carr, and an increasingly influential Assistant Secretary of State, Sumner Wells, another Harvard grad and a confidant of Roosevelt. A page, in fact, at Roosevelt's 1905 wedding, who had been instrumental in crafting the president's good neighbor policy. Dodd would have liked to return to America with some concrete proof that his approach to diplomacy, his interpretation of Roosevelt's mandate to serve as an exemplar of American values, had exerted a moderating influence on the Hitler regime, but all he had accrued thus far was repugnance for Hitler and his deputies, and grief for the lost Germany of his recollection. Shortly before his departure, however, there came a glint of light that heartened him and suggested that his efforts had not been wasted. On March 12th, an official of Germany's Foreign Office, Hans Heinrich Dickhoff, announced at a meeting of the German Press Club that henceforth Germany would require that a warrant be issued before any arrest, and that the notorious Columbia House prison would be closed. Dodd believed that he personally had much to do with the order. He would have been less heartened to learn of Hitler's private reaction to their last meeting, as recorded by Putzi Hanfstengel. Dodd made no impression, Hanfstengel wrote. Hitler was almost pitying. After the meeting, Hitler had said, Der gute Dodd. He can hardly speak German and made no sense at all. Which accorded rather closely with the reaction back in Washington of J. Pierpont Moffat. In his diary, Moffat wrote, Ambassador Dodd, quite without instruction, took up with Hitler the president's non-aggression idea and asked him point-blank if he would attend an international conference to discuss this. Where the ambassador got the idea that we wanted another international conference is a mystery. With clear exasperation, Moffat wrote, I am glad he is soon returning on leave. The night before his departure, Dodd went up to his bedroom and found Fritz, the butler, packing his suitcases. Dodd grew annoyed. He did not trust Fritz, but that wasn't the issue here. Rather, Fritz's efforts abraded his own Jeffersonian instincts. Dodd wrote in his diary, I do not think it is a disgrace for a man to pack his own bags. On Tuesday, March 13th, he and all his family drove to Hamburg, 180 miles northwest of Berlin, where he bade everyone goodbye and settled into his cabin aboard the SS Manhattan of the United States lines. Dodd was happily afloat when the German government's anger about the mock trial flared again. The Third Reich, it seemed, simply could not let the issue go. On the day of Dodd's sailing, fully 6 days after the trial, Ambassador Luther in Washington again called on Secretary Hull. According to Hull's account, Luther protested such offensive and insulting acts by the people of one country against the government and its officials of another country. By this point, Hull was losing patience. After offering a pro forma expression of regret and reiterating that the mock trial had no connection to the U.S. government, he launched a sly attack. I stated further that I trusted that the people of every country would, in the future, exercise such self-restraint as would enable them to refrain from excessive or improper manifestations or demonstrations on account of the action of peoples of another country. I sought to make this latter veiled reference to Germany plain. I then added generally that the world seems to be in a ferment to a considerable extent, with the result that the people in more countries than one are neither thinking nor acting normally. 10 days later, amid a snowstorm, the German ambassador returned yet again, angrier than ever. As Luther entered Hull's office, the secretary quipped that he hoped the ambassador was not feeling as cool as the snow falling outside. Using language that Hull described as almost violent, Luther spent the next 45 minutes angrily citing a list of abusive and insulting expressions of American citizens towards the Hitler government. Hull expressed his sorrow that America had become a target of German criticism, but then noted that at least my government was not alone in this situation, that virtually all the governments surrounding Germany, and also those in and about his country, seemed to be likewise in rather distinct disfavor on one account or another, and that his government as at present constituted seemed for some reason to be almost entirely isolated from all countries, although I did not intimate that it had been in the least at fault in a single instance. I said that it might be well, however, for his government to check its conditions of isolation and see where the trouble or fault lay. Hull also pointed out that America's relationship with previous German governments had been uniformly agreeable and stated that it was only during the control of the present government that the troubles complained of had arisen, much to our personal and official regret. He was careful to note that certainly this was mere coincidence. The whole problem would go away, Hull intimated, if Germany could only bring about a cessation of these reports of personal injuries, which had been coming steadily to the United States from Germany and arousing bitter resentment among many people here. Hull wrote, "We were clearly referring to the persecution of the Jews throughout the conversation." A week later, Secretary Hull launched what proved to be the final salvo on the matter. He had at last received the translation of the aide-memoire Neurath had given to Dodd. It was Hull's turn now to be angry. He sent an aide-memoir of his own, to be delivered in person to Neurath by the chargé d'affaires in Berlin, John C. White, who was running the embassy in Dodd's absence. After chiding Neurath on the tone of asperity unusual in diplomatic communication that had pervaded the German's aide-memoir, Hull gave him a brief lecture on American principles. He wrote, "It is well known that the free exercise of religion, the freedom of speech and of the press, and the right of peaceable assembly are not only guaranteed to our citizens by the Constitution of the United States, but are beliefs deep-seated in the political consciousness of the American people." And yet, Hull wrote, Neurath, in his aide-memoir, had described incidents where Germany felt the U.S. government should have disregarded these principles. It appears, therefore, that the points of view of the two governments, with respect to the issues of free speech and assembly, are irreconcilable, and that any discussion of this difference could not improve relations, which the United States government desires to preserve on as friendly a basis as the common interest of the two peoples demands. And thus, at last, the battle over the mock trial came to an end, with diplomatic relations chilly but intact. Once again, no one in the U.S. government had made any public statement either supporting the trial or criticizing the Hitler regime. The question remained, what was everyone afraid of? A U.S. senator, Millard E. Tidings of Maryland, tried to force Roosevelt to speak against Jewish persecution by introducing in the Senate a resolution that would have instructed the president to communicate to the government of the German Reich an unequivocal statement of the profound feelings of surprise and pain experienced by the people of the United States upon learning of discriminations and oppressions imposed by the Reich upon its Jewish citizens. A State Department memorandum on the resolution, written by Dodd's friend R. Walton Moore, Assistant Secretary of State, sheds light on the government's reluctance. After studying the resolution, Judge Moore concluded that it could only put Roosevelt in an embarrassing position. Moore explained, if he declined to comply with the request, he would be subjected to considerable criticism. On the other hand, if he complied with it, he would not only incur the resentment of the German government, but might be involved in a very acrimonious discussion with that government, which conceivably might, for example, ask him to explain why the Negroes of this country do not fully enjoy the right of suffrage, why the lynching of Negroes in Senator Tidings' state and other states is not prevented or severely punished, and how the anti-Semitic feeling in the United States, which unfortunately seems to be growing, is not checked. The resolution failed. Secretary Hull, according to one historian, exerted his influence with the Foreign Relations Committee to have it buried. Chapter 34 Diels, Afraid. With the approach of spring, as temperatures at last broke the 50-degree threshold, Martha began to notice a change in Diels. Usually so cool and suave, he seemed now to be on edge. He had good reason. The stress of his post increased markedly as Captain Rome pressed his demand for control of the military and as Heinrich Himmler sought to strengthen his grasp over secret police operations throughout Germany. Diels had once said that his job required that he sit on all sides of the fence at once. But now even he recognized his position was no longer tenable. His insider's view showed him the intensity of the passions at play and the unyielding character of the ambitions that underlay them. He knew as well that all parties involved viewed imprisonment and murder as useful political tools. He told Martha that even though he was now officially a colonel in Himmler's SS, he was hated by Himmler and his associates. He began to fear for his life, and at one point told Martha and Bill that he could be shot at any moment. "We didn't take too seriously what he said," she recalled. He had a tendency to be overly melodramatic, she knew, though she acknowledged that his job was one in which anyone might become hysterical or paranoid. The strain did seem to be taking a toll on his health, however. He complained, she wrote, of acute stomach and heart disorders. Sensing that a political eruption of some sort was inevitable, Diels met with Hermann Göring, still nominally his boss, to ask for a leave from the Gestapo. He cited illness as the reason. In his later memoir, he described Göring's reaction. "You are sick," Göring hissed. "You had better make up your mind to be very sick." "Yes, I am truly ill," Diels said. He told Göring he had done all he could to return the carriage of state to its proper path. But now, he said, "I cannot go on." "All right, you are ill," Göring said. "Therefore you cannot remain in service, not for a single day longer. You are confined to your home since you are ill. You will not make any long-distance calls or write any letters. Above all else, watch your step." Prudence dictated an alternative course. Once again, Diels left the country. But this time he checked himself into a sanatorium in Switzerland. Rumor held, not implausibly, that he had brought with him a cargo of damning secret files for delivery to a friend in Zurich, who was to publish everything if Diels was shot. A few weeks later, Diels returned to Berlin, and soon afterward he invited Martha and Bill to his apartment. Diels's wife led the pair into the living room, where they found Diels lying on a couch, looking anything but cured. A couple of pistols lay on a table beside him, next to a large map. Diels dismissed his wife, whom Martha described as a pathetic, passive-looking creature. The map, Martha saw, was covered with symbols and notations applied with inks of different colors that described a network of secret police posts and agents. Martha found it terrifying, a vast spider-web of intrigue. Diels was proud of it. "You know, most of this is my work," he said. "I have really organized the most effective system of espionage Germany has ever known." If he possessed such power, Martha asked him, why was he so clearly afraid? He answered, "Because I know too much." Diels needed to shore up his defenses. He told Martha that the more he and she could be seen together in public, the safer he would feel. This was no mere line aimed at rekindling their romance. Even Goering was coming to see Diels as an asset of fading value. Amid the storm of clashing passions whirling through Berlin that spring, the gravest danger to Diels arose from the fact that he continued to resist choosing a side, and as a result was distrusted in varying degrees by all camps. He grew sufficiently paranoid that he believed someone was trying to poison him. Martha had no objection to spending more time with Diels. She liked being associated with him and having the insider's view he afforded her. "I was young and reckless enough to want to be as closely in on every situation as I possibly could," she wrote. But again, she possessed what Diels did not, the assurance that, as the daughter of the American ambassador, she was safe from harm. A friend warned her, however, that in this case she was playing with fire. Over the weeks that followed, Diels stayed close to Martha and behaved, she wrote, like a frightened rabbit, though she also sensed that a part of Diels, the old confident Lucifer, reveled in the game of extricating himself from his predicament. In some ways, the danger he thought he was in was a challenge to his slyness and shrewdness, she recalled. Could he outwit them or not? Could he escape them or not? Chapter 35 Confronting the Club. Dodd's ship arrived at quarantine in New York Harbor on Friday, March 23rd. He had hoped that his arrival would escape notice by the press, but once again his plans were frustrated. Reporters routinely met the great ocean liners of the day on the presumption, generally valid, that someone of importance would be aboard. Just in case, Dodd had prepared a brief, five-sentence statement, and he soon found himself reading it to two reporters who had spotted him. He explained that he had come back to America on a short leave in order to get some much-needed rest from the tense European atmosphere. He added, "Contrary to the predictions of many students of international problems, I feel fairly certain that we shall not have war in the near future." He was heartened to find that the German vice consul in New York had come to meet the ship, bearing a letter from Hitler for delivery to Roosevelt. Dodd was especially pleased that his friend Colonel House had sent his handsome limousine to pick him up and bring him to the Colonel's Manhattan home at East 68th Street and Park Avenue to wait for his train to Washington, D.C. A lucky thing, Dodd wrote in his diary, because taxi drivers were on strike, and if I had gone to a hotel, the newspaper folk would have pestered me until my train for Washington departed. Dodd and the Colonel had a candid talk. House gave me valuable information about unfriendly officials in the State Department with whom I would have to deal. Best of all, soon after his arrival, Dodd received the latest chapter of his Old South, freshly typed by Martha's friend Mildred Fish Harnack and sent via diplomatic pouch. In Washington, Dodd checked into the Cosmos Club, which at the time stood on Lafayette Square, just north of the White House. On his first morning in Washington, he walked to the State Department for the first of many meetings and lunches. At 11 o'clock he met with Secretary Hull and Undersecretary Phillips. All three spent a good deal of time puzzling out how to respond to Hitler's letter. Hitler praised Roosevelt's efforts to restore America's economy and stated that duty, readiness for sacrifice, and discipline were virtues that should be dominant in any culture. These moral demands, which the president places before every individual citizen of the United States, are also the quintessence of the German state philosophy, which finds its expression in the slogan, "The public weal transcends the interests of the individual." Phillips called it a strange message. To Dodd, as well as to Hull and Phillips, it was obvious that Hitler hoped to draw a parallel between himself and Roosevelt, and that the obligatory U.S. reply would have to be drafted very carefully. That task fell to Phillips and Western European Affairs Chief Moffat, the goal being, Moffat wrote, to prevent our falling into the Hitler trap. The resulting letter thanked Hitler for his kind words, but noted that his message applied not to Roosevelt personally, but rather to the American people as a whole, who have freely and gladly made heroic efforts in the interest of recovery. In his diary, Phillips wrote, "We sought to sidestep the impression that the president was becoming a fascist." The next day, Monday, March 26th, Dodd strolled to the White House for lunch with Roosevelt. They discussed a surge of hostility toward Germany that had arisen in New York in the wake of the mock trial earlier in the month. Dodd had heard one New Yorker express the fear that there might easily be a little civil war in New York City. "The president also spoke of this," Dodd wrote, "and asked me if I would do so to get Chicago Jews to call off their mock trial set for mid-April." Dodd agreed to try. He wrote to Jewish leaders, including Leo Wurmser, to ask them to quiet things, if possible, and wrote as well to Colonel House to ask him to exert his influence in the same direction. As anxious as Dodd was to get to his farm, he did relish the prospect of a conference set for early that week, at which he at last would have the opportunity to bring his criticism of the policies and practices of the Foreign Service directly to the boys of the Pretty Good Club. He spoke before an audience that included Hull, Moffat, Phillips, Wilbur Carr, and Sumner Wells. Unlike in his Columbus Day speech in Berlin, Dodd was blunt and direct. The days of Louis XIV and Victoria style had passed, he told them. Nations were bankrupt, including our own. The time had come to cease grand style performances. He cited an American consular official who had shipped enough furniture to fill a 20-room house and yet had only 2 people in his family. He added that a mere assistant of his had a chauffeur, a porter, a butler, a valet, 2 cooks, and 2 maids. Every official, he said, should be required to live within his salary, be it the $3,000 a year of a junior officer or the $17,500 that he himself received as a full-fledged ambassador. And everyone should be required to know the history and customs of his host country. The only men sent abroad should be those who think of their country's interests, not so much about a different suit of clothes each day, or sitting up at gay but silly dinners and shows every night until 1 o'clock. Dodd sensed that this last point struck home. He noted in his diary, "Sumner Wells winced a little. The owner of a mansion in Washington which outshines the White House in some respects and is about as large." Wells's mansion, called by some the House with 100 Rooms, stood on Massachusetts Avenue off DuPont Circle and was renowned for its opulence. Wells and his wife also owned a 255-acre country estate just outside the city, Oxon Hill Manor. After Dodd concluded his remarks, his audience praised him and applauded. I was not fooled, however, after 2 hours of pretended agreement. Indeed, his lecture only deepened the ill feelings of the Pretty Good Club. By the time of his talk, some of its members, most notably Phillips and Moffat, privately had begun to express real hostility. Don paid a visit to Moffat's office. Later that day, Moffat wrote a brief assessment of the ambassador in his diary. He is by no means a clear thinker. He will express great dissatisfaction with a situation and then reject every proposal to remedy it. He dislikes all his staff, but yet does not wish any transferred. He is suspicious by turns of nearly everyone with whom he comes in contact, and a little jealous. Moffat called him an unfortunate misfit. Dodd seemed unaware that he might be conjuring forces that could endanger his career. Rather, he delighted in pricking the clubby sensibilities of his opponents. With clear satisfaction, he told his wife, their chief protector, presumably he meant Phillips or Wells, is not a little disturbed. If he attacks, it certainly is not in the open. Chapter 36 Saving Diels. The fear Diels felt grew more pronounced, to the point where in March he again went to Martha for help, this time in hopes of using her to acquire assistance from the U.S. Embassy itself. It was a moment freighted with irony, the chief of the Gestapo seeking aid from American officials. Somehow Diels had gotten wind of a plan by Himmler to arrest him, possibly that very day. He had no illusions. Himmler wanted him dead. Diels knew he had allies at the American Embassy, namely Dodd and Consul General Messerschmitt, and believed they might be able to provide a measure of safety by expressing to Hitler's regime their interest in his continued well-being. But Dodd, he knew, was on leave. Diels asked Martha to speak with Messerschmitt, who by now had returned from his own leave, to see what he could do. Despite Martha's inclination to view Diels as overly dramatic, this time she did believe he faced mortal peril. She went to see Messerschmitt at the consulate. She was obviously in a greatly perturbed situation, Messerschmitt recalled. She broke down in tears and told him that Diels was to be arrested that day and that it was almost certain that he would be executed. She composed herself, then pleaded with Messerschmitt to meet with Göring at once. She tried flattery, calling Messerschmitt the only man who could intercede without being in danger of his own life. Messerschmitt was unmoved. By now he had grown to dislike Martha. He found her behavior, her various love affairs, repugnant. Given her presumed relationship with Diels, Messerschmitt was not surprised that she had come to his office in this hysterical state. He told her he could do nothing, and after a great deal of difficulty was able to get her out of my office. After she left, however, Messerschmitt began to reconsider. I began thinking about the matter and realized that she was correct in saying one thing, and that is that Diels, after all, was one of the best in the regime, as was Göring, and that in case anything happened to Diels and Himmler came in, it would weaken the position of Göring and of the more reasonable element in the party. If Himmler ran the Gestapo, Messerschmitt believed, he and Dodd would have far more difficulty resolving future attacks against Americans, for Himmler was known to be even more cold-blooded and ruthless than Dr. Diels. Messerschmitt was scheduled to attend a luncheon that afternoon at the Heron Club, a men's club for conservatives, hosted by two prominent Reichswehr generals. But now, recognizing that a talk with Göring was far more important, Messerschmitt saw that he might have to cancel. He called Göring's office to arrange the meeting and learned that Göring had just left for a luncheon of his own, at the Heron Club. Messerschmitt hadn't known until then that Göring was to be the guest of honor at the general's lunch. He realized two things. First, that the task of speaking with Göring had suddenly become much simpler, and second, that the luncheon was a landmark. It was the first time since the Nazis came to power that the highest-ranking officers of the German army were going to sit down to a table with Göring or any high-ranking member of the Nazi regime. It struck him that the lunch might signal that the army and government were closing ranks against Captain Röhm and his stormtroopers. If so, it was an ominous sign, for Röhm was not likely to jettison his ambitions without a fight. Messersmith arrived at the club shortly after noon and found Goering conversing with the generals. Goering put his arm around Messersmith's shoulders and told the others, "Gentlemen, this is a man who doesn't like me at all, a man who doesn't think very much of me, but he is a good friend of our country."